land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Oh my, if only that that song had elements that were true. You know, I listen to it and it's inviting, but of course it just isn't reality. I would be surprised if there were a single Jew and all of Israel that is walking with Yah. And Yah's primary purpose is to free his people, and yet they are enslaved to all manner of political and religious corruptions. We're here with a little bit different cast this evening. We've got Kirk with a heart tied behind his back as his beloved wife is still struggling in her recovery from surgery, but taking a brief reprieve from hospital duties. And we have Dee joining us in lieu of JB, who is going to be out the next 2 weeks. So I thank both of you. I read in the news today that the War Project seminar at Brown University has come up with the total for the cost and consequence of the so-called war on terror. It was started launched by George W. Bush in the wake of the September 11th, 2001 suicide bombing on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. How many Americans were killed in the 9/11 suicide attacks on those buildings?
It's around about 3,000, I believe, right? Close to that number.
That's correct. That's the number.
I think so.
But how many Americans were killed at Pearl Harbor?
About 2,400, I think, or something like that.
Just shy of 3,000. How many Americans were sacrificed to avenge their death in World War II? How many American soldiers lost their lives?
About 350,000, I think.
Yeah. So we sacrificed 350,000 Americans to avenge the death of 3,000. And we consider that a great victory on behalf of our country. We had 3,000 Americans that died as a result of the Islamic suicide bombings on 9/11. We are unwilling as a country to say that it is a war against fundamentalist Islam. And according to Brown University study, do you know how many people have died as a result of our so-called war on terror to avenge the death of those 3,000?
It's got to be, counting all the collateral damage, it's got to be in the millions.
If they actually documented the collateral damage, the people that have been killed collaterally, for example, the entire war in Syria is collateral damage, and all the refugees that are fleeing out of Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq are collateral damage. It's in the millions, but just as a direct consequence of what the U.S. has done, the death toll is 801,000 lives have been sacrificed
in
the death of 3,000 Americans. And would you like to guess how much we've squandered of the nation's
trillions.
Treasury to affect that,
like
that immoral
toll? A number of years ago, it was 6 trillion. I think, or
yep.
something number like that. So
6 trillion is the number.
6.4.
6.4 trillion.
Wow.
Such is the noble cause of the United States of America. We should be so proud. Kirk, I know that you mentioned that you took some time and wrote a summation of what we were discovering. And what we find here, and you may even be a little beyond where we are in the text, as I show that we're going to pick up our story on Mizmor Psalm 89:22. But the 89th Psalm is so much more than I think any of us expected. It's much more than I had expected when I began the translation. We had come up with psalm after psalm, prophecy after prophecy of Yahweh expressing everything that he was doing for and with Dod. That Dod is his Messiah. That Dod is his son.
Yes.
That Dod is his chosen one. That Dod is his Zeruah, his shepherd. In fact, he even calls Dod the King of Kings. And we learn that the second coming is actually with Dod. And that Dod's seat of honor on earth and in heaven is going to be everlasting. We even learn in this Mizmor that when Dod is brought back, his soul united with Yahweh's spirit, he's going to be as brilliant as the sun in Yahweh's presence. He is more than everything that Christians have sought to wrongly ascribe to the Passover lamb.
Absolutely.
And yet the Christian religion, at Paul's direction, has sought to usurp everything that Yahweh offered to and ascribed to Dod, to such a degree that Yahweh was really angry. In fact, he even says, if all of these things that I have said, I have given to Dod, are not true, then I'm a liar. And yet, nonetheless, we will prove, based upon a thorough examination of Paul's first speech during his first missionary journey in a place that would soon be called Hadrianopolis, that Paul, in fact, sought to diminish Dod to nothing more than a sperm donor. And what has happened through all of this is that a religion came to grow out of what was once a relationship. And the Passover lamb has been elevated to a cult leader. And that all of the things that God sought to achieve have been annulled or overlooked or demeaned. And as a result, rather than the chosen people looking to Dod as their Messiah, as their king, as the Son of God. Christians would take all of these things away from him and then use the result to bludgeon Jews. It's one of the saddest and most despicable stories and untold stories in the whole history of the Jewish people. In fact, that was the, if there was any one thought that became germane as we were translating the 89th Mizmor and then went into, and we'll do this in later shows, goes into Romans, no, Acts 13, to read what Paul's co-worker Luke had to say about the emasculation of Dodd. That this is central, the very heart and soul of the greatest conspiracy of all time. And if there's anything that we have learned that is more important than this for the chosen people, I don't know what it is.
It's little wonder they want nothing to do with the Christian Christ.
Of course.
It's blasphemous to them.
Yeah. In fact, the Christian Christ wants nothing to do with them.
Right.
Yeah. Everything the Christian Christ has to say about them is horrible.
That's right.
You know, it's that, you know, God made, chose these people and stuck with them all the way, admonishing them as a loving father, but continuing to say, I have made this promise to you and I'm going to keep it. And that the largest swath of prophecy is about the reconciliation of Yahweh and his people. And yet the Christian Christ becomes their worst enemy. The Christian Christ comes as the Passover lamb and then gets all bent out of shape that the Jews are presenting him as such. It's the most preposterous thing you could ever imagine, but it is the basis of the Christian religion. So, Kirk, what did you come up with?
Well, it started, Craig and Dee, it started because I had an encounter of the Christian kind this week. A couple in the neighborhood invited me to dinner, and I want to tell you, they're about as nice a bunch of people you ever want to meet. But they asked me what I was doing now that I've retired and closed down my studio, and I told them. And that shocked them beyond belief because I told them what I was studying. And they hit me with all the cliches of Christianity, you know, and they started to look at me like I'm Satan has walked into their house. And I thought about, do I get in a debate with this? And it's no good. I'm in their house. I'm not going to do that. Then they asked me to pray while we had dinner, and I said, I can't do that. They said, you don't pray? And I said, no. And so that, anyway, so what I did is I went home, and I started reading Question in Paul. And I couldn't get through 35 pages without destroying Paul. I would suggest anybody who's in this dilemma should. But what I did today is I wrote down, or last night, I wrote down kind of a new outline of what we've grown to know now that we didn't know when you wrote Question in Paul about Dodd. And I stated that I went through is what Yosha actually came upon the scene in order to fulfill Pesach, and which is the consequence, of course, of bodily death that releases the soul, which has three options in life. And then Yahweh's soul was placed in Sheol and in order to fill matzah or unyeasted bread. So both events, I said, were necessary to fulfill his promise to Abraham, because remember, he said, I'll provide the sacrifice. He didn't come.
Right.
Yep. So, yeah, y'all jump in and tell me if something is off key here, but this is really just a little synopsis. But he did not come, Yosha, he did not come to change or to add anything to the Torah's message. He paid the ransom. Yah felt all the pain personally, because the pain is felt through his soul, or his consciousness, or subconscious, or consciousness. And we know that because you can read the Psalms by Dodd of 22 and 88, because he chronicles it all there. Now, at no point, I went on to say, at no point then, nor in the future, were we to focus upon Yahusha other than through these three Moed Mikras. That's when we celebrate the events. Our focus is and was and should be on Yahweh and his word, the Torah, that's found in the Torah. His best human teacher of this document and the most knowledgeable of the person of Yahweh was his beloved son and co-worker, Dode.
Right.
So I said.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just trying to put it all together where I might actually be able to use it if somebody wants to talk about this. I said the plague of death, Paul, firstly, he needed to elevate Yahusha to the highest status obtainable, which is God. And then he renamed him, renamed him Christo and remade him in the image of Dionysus or Talmuz, if you like, making him palatable to the world of the Goyim who worship, praise, and pray to him for their favors. Second thing he did, which is, this is a coup d'etat. The second thing Paul did is he ignored Dode and transferred all his promises, as you just stated, all his promises to the new improved God, thus nullifying the need to shamar the words of Yah's best teacher. Thirdly, I said, Paul discarded the Torah and replaced it with the gospel of grace. What I say, no Torah, no rebuttal, because once you diminish that or once you throw that away or burn it as the Romans did, then you have no source to say, wait a minute, that ain't what it says, like we do now, fortunately. And fourthly, I said that the plague of death painted the chosen people as an unworthy, no longer his, Yahweh's being his being Yahweh, loathsome, and even the murderers of his new God. And when his cancer grew through the Rome, it left no chance that Yehuda could surface and really stand against Paul's creation. They would have been killed, and they were.
Yeah.
How many there were that could have stood up there and knew enough to do it, I don't know, because of rabbinical Judaism, there was Pharisees and Sadducees and all that had already dominated the area. So not many of them were really going back to and becoming Torah observant, but outside of a few that followed Yahusha. But is that a pretty good nutshell?
You know why Paul had to elevate the Passover lamb to God? Do you ever think about why he had to do it?
Well, he has to get the focus away from Yahweh.
That's part of it, yes, because everything he says about Yahweh, Yahweh can't save, Yahweh's mean, wrathful, that his Torah is completely unable to do anybody any good. And so since Yahweh cannot save, he can't be the spokesperson for Yahweh.
And then the second thing I would
have credibility, he still has to speak for a God. And so what he did is he made Jesus into a God. Now, if Yahusha were God, do you think he would have told us?
Once or twice.
Did he? Did he ever refer to himself as God?
No.
Did he ever refer to himself as the Messiah?
No.
No.
Did he ever refer to himself as even the Son of God?
No.
Son of man.
By the way, we do have JB with us. JB, I thought you were going to be on vacation, but welcome. I'm glad you're here. We're enjoying Kirk's analysis of kind of where we have been and what this all means. But it is interesting that we're so accustomed to associating, if you ask somebody, you know, what's God's name, they'll say Jesus Christ. And I said, you think that the totality of you think God actually fits within a human persona?
Yeah, but the pagans at large were obsessed with a demigod, a man god. Mm-hmm. So Paul was selling something to people that were already prepared to accept that.
Yes, because all the pagan gods all had human figures. I mean, Dionysus is always shown in the form of a really handsome man.
Which really shows you where Paul was going with all of this to begin with.
Yes.
Well, before you go away from
God who could endorse him, but then what was really interesting for those who think that he was chosen by and spoke for this man God, how many times in all of Paul's 14 letters and throughout the book of Acts where he speaks voluminously, how many times did he quote him?
I know of one.
One.
And he misquoted him at that.
Do you know what the topic was?
Zero?
It's one throughout all of his 14 letters and all of the book of Acts. It's one time. And the one time he quoted him, he misquoted him. He took something he said about the covenant, turned it into a new covenant when he said nothing of the sort, and took it completely out of context and took about six words out of context and misrepresented them. That was it.
What a guy. The other half of that question you gave me was that because he needed to get all the promises away from Dode and put them on Crystal. Is that the answer?
Yes. Okay. Right. Yeah, well, it's not just that it's just not. I mean, it's two things that he had to do. Is one is that God made a choice, and the person that he chose to be the most important in human history, the most relevant, is Dode. He personally anointed Dode. His spirit came upon Dode when he was a young boy. He chose Dode out of being a shepherd in Bethlehem. He chose Dode to be the king of his people. He chose Dode to return with him and to be king of the millennial kingdom. He chose Dode's throne to be the seat of honor in heaven. He chose Dode to be Messiah and king and the branch and his chosen one. Everything that you could possibly choose for a person, he chose for Dode. Dode is the center of this story. He was not only born and lived in at 3,000 Yah, halfway between the beginning and the time leaving the Garden of Eden and the time when we re-enter it with the celebration of Sukkah in 2033. He is set right in the middle of everything. And so Paul had to dismiss him because he is Yahweh's spokesperson. And he's the person who writes more, who has to say more, who has more said of him than anyone else. And so that person's voice had to be muted. He muted Moses by annulling the Torah. But he annulled the covenant by destroying and nullifying all the promises that God had made to Dode. So Dode becomes nothing more than a seed sperm donor, and Moshe becomes nothing more than a lawgiver, and they're both swept aside so that what I, Paul, say is all that matters. And then Paul claimed that he represented Yosha when he contradicted everything he said and did. And the carnage that has resulted has left the chosen people battered and bruised, killed by the millions, by the church that Paul spawned. And in the process, Jews are lost. The secular ones, of course, don't think there will ever be a Messiah, and the religious ones are looking for one that has not arrived, that's going to somehow save them, when in fact he has been here and he is returning. So it is it's devastating. The consequence of everyone being blinded of all of this, and I understand why there isn't a thinking Jew in the world that would want to do as Christians ask and accept Jesus as their Messiah. because Jesus isn't their Messiah. He isn't anybody's Messiah. And everything
we use, we're not. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Jesus of the New Testament loves Rome and hates Jews.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the things that I learned, and I actually got scolded by one of the listeners to this program, and I admitted that he was right. I was wrong. When I introduced this psalm, I said that one of the things it's going to lead to is a wholesale repudiation of the so-called Gospel of Matthew, and we're going to get to it, and it's going to rip into shreds. And he said, you know, what I thought you were going to end up with is where we really need to be, which is a repudiation of the entire Christian New Testament, not just Paul's letters and not just the so-called Gospel of Matthew, but all of it. And then he cited about 8 to 10 things that are attributed to the Christian Jesus in the so-called Gospels, where he speaks against his people on behalf of Rome. And he says, you know, what you need to have the courage and the character, the sense of reason to condemn it all. And I suspect he's right.
Yeah.
I think that we're going to find that there are a few things in it that ring true. But they're far
you have to sell it.
Prospective lies work.
Yeah, you got to have it to sell it. Yeah, you can't make a forgery without something.
Yes, and that is the reason why there's some things in it that read true. I had another person that was criticizing my support for Revelation, and I don't know why they get the feeling that I'm supporting Revelation, because I'm really not. I see lots and lots of issues with Revelation that are troubling, but much of Revelation is a paraphrase of Zechariah and Jeremiah and Yeshayah and Daniel. And so, yeah, any time that someone quotes from or surmises what was said by a legitimate prophet, should they add an interesting insight that can be derived from them, or they put those prophets' texts together in such a way that they make connections which facilitate understanding, then I at least want to consider it, particularly if you can attest to it through the proven prophets of old. But
it's the same as Yosha quoting from Dabarim when he says, don't change a jot or a tittle, don't change a letter or anything in it. I mean, he's quoting directly from Moshe, so that's accurate regardless. So that's good.
Yeah.
But that one goes to the bank with the rest of it.
And Paul quotes from the Torah prophets and Psalms, though it's all bad, because he doesn't get a single quotation correct. He misappropriates and misconstrues all of them, when in context, they actually speak directly against the point he is making.
Yes.
Now, in a debate, if you misappropriate evidence, if it can be shown that you've miscited the source, it does not matter what else you have to say. You've lost the debate.
Yeah.
It's just over at that point.
Yeah.
And you only get to do it once. In fact, you can't even do it once. If it can be proven that you have misquoted your source and misrepresented your source once, it's over. You've lost the debate. Kirk, do you want to go on with your findings, or do you want us to return to?
That was kind of in a nutshell what I was writing on. So just those were the things that just jumped out as I finished off your what I thought was 120 pages. We write 8 more pages, so that's what I read last night. That was another. I was just amazed because of how far we've come. Now I will say one thing that in going back to questioning Paul, when you talk about Yahusha, you wrote Messiah, which doing the work of Yah is most definitely a title he could use, or you could use that as a, you know, so you didn't call him the Messiah, you called him the Messiah, which is fine.
Yeah, I'm a bit squeamish on that, but I'm also glad, because the last thing I want to have to do is go through and edit 10,000 pages of prior work. I don't mind being called wrong. I've made lots of mistakes, and if I had used the term Messiah relative to Yahusha, I would have been wrong. Fortunately, one of the things I recognized is the term, the title Messiah was never once applied to Yahusha. And that even when in Daniel it uses Messiah towards a person who isn't actually named, but we would assume that it would be Yahusha, it isn't used as a title, but instead as an adjective modifying messenger.
Yeah,
and so he has never afforded the title of Messiah. And to my credit, I recognize that. And so what I look for is there a term, even if it's not ascribed directly to him, that might be similar to that that would be fitting? And I found that Maaseyah, the work of Yah, was used 22 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and it means the work of Yah. And that since Yahusha is a diminished manifestation doing the work of Yah, being about the Father's business, the title was, I thought, appropriate to apply, but I was still honest in saying it's never officially ascribed to him, but it certainly fits.
I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, but I, you know, I say that and with my stomach churning and saying, you know, going, knowing what I know now, I don't even think I would have gone that far.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because not only isn't Yahusha the Messiah, that line that is the one that seems to infer that he is that is the one where Shimon, you know, who is now called Peter. That's kind of a whole kettle of fish by itself. You know, Peter is the, it's from Petros, the
yes.
Greek word for rock. And
correct.
So, but Yahusha didn't speak Greek. And so I, in my original writing, looked at the lexicons, and the lexicons say that it was that he referred to as Shimon Kephesh, being that Kephesh was the Aramaic term for rock, but that's not correct. It's from Kesh, which is the Hebrew term, but not for rock, but for the indentations, the poorest portions of a rock. And so, and it's, and Kephesh also the basis of Kippur, which means to reconcile. And so if Yahusha meant it as a disparaging comment, he'd say, you know, you've got all the worth of the indentations or the perforations and holes, the hollow places within a rock. Now that would be pretty degrading. So
yeah.
I don't think that rock was intended. First of all, I don't even think Yahusha made the comment. But if he did make the comment, it was from Kesh, which means to reconcile. And there it should, therefore, it never should have been translated into Greek as Petros, rock, or they're transliterated into English as Peter. It is that whole thing, you know, and then upon this rock I will build my church. When we've gone over it a gazillion times, if I had said, he would say, upon this shore, but it's, I will build the family, Bana, based upon the Mikra, because Ecclesia is a translation of Mikra and Mikra to call out. To call out is a translation into English of Ecclesia, and Ecclesia was a translation of Mikra and Mikra. But what we found is that that statement is not in, and it's only found in the Gospel of Matthew. And yet it's not recorded in any 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, or 9th century fragment. It's only found in the Codex Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, which are one of the greatest frauds ever perpetrated on humankind. And so the line was likely written by the source of Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, who is Eusebius, who is among the greatest villains in this whole story. So that upon this rock I will build my church, and which became the basis of the seat of St. Peter and of Roman Catholic authority,
mm-hmm.
was all fabricated. Conversation never took place. And so that was the only place where Yosha could even be considered acknowledging someone else calling him the Christ or the Messiah. And it's not true. So Yosha came as the Passover lamb. Let's be grateful for what he did. Let's appreciate what he did. Let's appreciate what Yahweh did through him to provide us with eternal life through the Pesach lamb. It's a marvelous, marvelous thing that Yahweh did for us that we should be appreciative of, but we should be appreciative not to Yosha, but to Yahweh for doing this.
To Yahweh, yes.
Yeah.
But Yahweh doesn't want a lot of credit. He knows who he is. He's comfortable who he is. He does what he does for our benefit. And therefore, the person that he wants to credit is not mini-me, the diminished manifestation of himself, if we can even be that bold in our description of Yosha, but instead his favorite son. So.
It makes more sense that way.
Yes, understandable.
You know, as a loving father, Yahweh says this of his beloved son. He says the adversary, the oyeb, the hostile opposition, the enemy, the one with animosity and enmity and rancor, masculine singular, will not nullify him, Shoah. It's interesting that Shoah here, it means to nullify. You know, Shoah, as we will just mention in a moment, Shoah is the operative verb. And the third statement that Yahweh etched in stone, which he says that anyone that Shoah nullifies my name, I will not forgive. Well, there's a lot of people that have thought to nullify Yahweh's name by removing Yahweh's name from the text of his prophetic revelation 7,000 times. And then telling the world, well, we nullified it. We took it out because we have too much respect for it. Wait a minute. If you take something away from someone's own testimony and deny its existence there, that's the opposite of respect. That's nullification. That's to negate. That's unforgivable. And so the adversary will not nullify him, Shoah, will not negate his value or annul his position or purpose. The 89th Mizmor is about one individual, Dode. And so he's saying that Satan himself will not negate his value or annul his position or purpose. Yahweh himself is making this statement about Dode because Dode is the single most important person who ever lived. And then he says, and the son of evil, Ben-Awa, the son of wickedness, the child of malice and injustice, the seed of the one who is wrong, harmful, and damaging to others. Awal is transliterated evil in the Masoretic text, the evil one, shall not deny him nor denigrate him, shall not silence him nor stop him, will not negate his answers nor nullify his responsive declaration. This, to my thinking, is perhaps the most pivotal statement in the progression of the religious response to Yahweh. I don't know how you could find a, in all of human history, a statement more pivotal than this one. For if God is saying, I'm not going to allow the adversary to nullify him, what is Satan attempting to do?
He's trying to nullify.
There you go.
Yeah.
And if Satan has an accomplice, masculine singular, Ben Awa, the son of evil, then we have to look for somebody who acknowledged that they were demon-possessed and who is seeking, along with Satan, to nullify and degrade Dote.
Well, that's an easy call.
There'll be one of those.
That's a very short one.
Well, you know, some would say, well, you know, you're projecting. There could be other people. Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah?
Well, you wanted to tell me somebody who is so well known for having done this that billions of people cling on him, his every word as if he were writing scripture. Why don't you tell me somebody else? Why don't you give me the entire list and we'll debate them?
Significantly, those who do so over and above Dode's writing.
Now, part of this here is that let's just say that that JB talked me into it, and that I was on the sidelines here, and that you know there could be somebody else besides Paul. Well. Doesn't Yahweh name Shaul in this song as the adversary? Tell him out by name. He calls him out by name. And so it's just like Chabaoth. You can't get around it. Not only was everything that Chabaoth prophesied about what Paul would do precisely fitting for that one individual. And there's two chapters of it where he describes everything that the man would do that was counter to God. And then he calls him out by name. Calls him Shaul. So you only got two Shauls to choose from. One is the wannabe king who is long since gone. And the other one changed the course.
He didn't write anything.
I was about to say that. He left no written testimony against Dode.
Yeah, he wasn't very helpful for the cause because of what he wrote, because he didn't write anything.
But the fact that he was against Dode is germane to this, because everything that is said about King Shaul is prophetic of the self-proclaimed apostle, Shaul.
Mm-hmm.
Both were demon possessed. Both were Benjamites. Both...
Yeah. Agree with that.
We're against Dode and counter to the Torah. One's prophetic of the other. It was of King Shaul that God said, if you choose him, you are choosing to oppose and reject me.
Yes.
And that here's what he's going to do to you. And by choosing to believe the self-proclaimed apostle Paul, Christians are rejecting Yahweh. And he did.
It's hard to get over the 10% tithe thing. You know how Yahweh told them that he would take 10%. And then Shaul II did exactly that. How do you miss that connection? And that's just one of many.
Everything about him is prophetic. That's the only reason we know about Shaul and his opposition to Dode. It's prophetic of the man that would be the son of evil. The adversary, Oleb, will not nullify him, Shoah. And the son of evil, Ben Awa, shall not deny him nor denigrate him. Lo, Ana, you will not silence him nor stop him. Will not negate his answers or nullify his response or declarations. So as I mentioned, Shoah wasn't chosen by happenstance, nor was Allah. Shoah is used in the third statement, Yahweh etched in stone. to say that he would not forgive anyone who sought to nullify or negate the value of his name. He's not going to allow Satan to denigrate nor silence those. As for Allah, it is used in Chabaouk 2:2 to reveal that Shaul, the plague of death, would build an evil edifice. Therefore, Yah was trying to tie these things together for us as clues so that we might understand Satan's desire to denigrate Yahweh's chosen. God does not want us to be fooled into trivializing the Son of God, nor into worshiping the Son of Man. Now, while the adversary, as Hasatan, is clearly singular in the text, and his prodigy, the son of evil, is singular, when working together as they did to conceive Christianity, they became sare, adversarial foes. Beyond this, the best way, or the best of my knowledge, there is only three prominent individuals who claim to speak for God while admitting to being demon-possessed. Your choices are King Shaul, the wannabe apostle and false prophet, Shaul, Paul, and the acclaimed messenger of God, Muhammad.
Yep.
Those are the three. However, since the plague of death was explicitly named Shaul in Chabaouk, it doesn't take a genius to ascertain which of these nefarious fellows earned the title Son of Evil. More to the point, Shaul's name will soon appear within this mizmor, as we've mentioned, eliminating any doubt as to the identity of the wicked child. May we applaud Yah, the title is fitting. It is stupefying, in my view. Absolutely stupefying. And this is the thing that has just pounded at me this past few weeks as I've been writing this chapter. And this is tough sledding. I mean, dealing with Paul's rubbish and what the Christians have done against Jews and Yahweh really, really irks me. And I get agitated. It's difficult. I've come to love Yah and his people. Love Dote. And to see what this man has done, I'm agitated through the process. And I find it, as I say, just stupefying that no one has bothered to ask. If Shaul Paul is so goddamn important as he claims, if he's the lone apostle to the Gentile world, why are all the prophetic references that name him so decidedly negative? Why isn't there a single positive comment about the principal author of the Christian New Testament to be found anywhere in prophecy? If it is Shaul that we should be listening to, why is Dode, the man whose status and testimony Paul has sought to annul, featured in more prophecies than everyone else combined? If Paul is telling the truth and Dode is lying, why is it that Paul consistently misquotes and contradicts God while Yah proclaims that Dode is right?
Not to interrupt, but Paul admitted in Romans that he was lying.
Yes.
So yes, he admitted also to being enslaved to his flesh and many other horrible, being evil. He called himself evil.
Yes.
And he does. Still fallen.
Out of the donkey's mouth.
I mean, his opus is Romans. And it was written by a nincompoop. It is so pathetic. And it's even hard to justify the time to point out how irrational it is.
Yeah.
It's so poorly written. And that's his magnus opus. Yeah. And you just think about it. It was for the Romans, to the Romans, in which he said that even the Roman government was established by God for good and that we ought to submit to them. This is the same Rome who under Pompey in, what, about 60-some-odd BCE came into
the Christians call it the Romans Road.
Giggles and murdered 12,000 Jews.
Oh, yeah.
This is the same Rome that waltzed into to Jerusalem after their man had formed bonds with thieves and robbed the treasury. And the Jews just said, no, you can't do that. And so the response of Rome was to send in legions and slaughter Jews.
Yeah.
And then this is the same, and that was occurring as Paul was writing his letter to the Romans.
Yep.
The same Rome that would come back under Hadrian and completely destroy everything. I mean, how in the world would anyone believe, unless you were a Roman, a letter speaking on behalf of the Romans, written by a guy who claims to speak to the to God, whose people were abused and murdered in mass by the Romans.
Yeah. It's very damaging.
And of course, it's the Romans who killed the Christian God.
Yeah.
He wasn't the Jews. He wasn't stoned to death. He was crucified.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Why is Shaul's name synonymous with Sheol? What does it mean, question him? Why is he a Benjamite, a wolf, if he is to believe? Why does Dod's name beloved, why is he from Yahudah, loved of Yah? Why does Yahweh cite him and not Paul, if Dod is to be ignored? And it's not just Yahweh who cites Dod, Yosha did. In fact, at the seminal moment of Yosha's life, to explain what was happening on Pesach,
he quoted Dod.
He cited from Dod's 22nd Mizmah. Why is Dod afforded almost every meaningful title by God himself? From the chosen one to the set apart one. From the Son of God to the hand of God. From the Messiah to the King. From the branch to the protective shepherd. If we aren't supposed to value his contribution to our lives. Why is Dod accompanying Yahweh upon his return and not Paul? And then presented ruling the world if his life and testimony are to be discounted? Why are the only titles associated with Shaul Paul, father of lives, son of evil, and plague of death? If there's anything good or right about him. Asked another way. Since the book of Acts claims that Paul was such a big shot, such a persuasive orator and prolific writer, a man who traveled throughout the Greco-Roman world, the best student of Gamaliel, the leading rabbi of the day, the man who met with numerous kings along the way, why isn't there a single reference to him in any of the communities or nations he visited? Having given speeches before provincial governors, kings, and emperors, why didn't a court scribe record his message? Why isn't the Christian globetrotter mentioned by Tacitus, Pliny, or Josephus, nor even by a rabbi?
Didn't happen.
Why is Paul's written account of his life in Galatians so incompatible with the story he told Luke in Acts? Why did he die a miserable death and alone, rejected by all he sought to influence? why did those who listened to Paul and rejected him, what did they realize that Christians fail to recognize today? Now, rest assured, before the presentation of all of this is concluded, we're going to expose Shaul's irrational attempts, both spoken and written, to Sari, constrain and restrict the importance of Dod, the beloved of Yah. You will know, as does God, why the plague of death must be banished and vanquished. Standing up for the one who stood with him, Yah reveals, and so I will pulverize and crush his foes, especially those who seek to constrain and restrict him. Then out of his presence I will plague those who shun him by attempting to decrease his status. Do you think God would have said this if Dod's status was irrelevant to us?
Hardly.
No.
Do you think that God would say this if there wasn't something tremendous being lost amongst his people and the world by Dod being robbed of everything Yahweh promised him? If those promises relative to this man didn't make a tremendous difference in our lives? Here is God saying that not only would a religion rise up in conjunction with Satan and this son of evil to try to deprive Yahweh and his people of all of the promises that he made to them and to Dod, that God himself is going to say, you know, I'm not going to take it. I'm his father, and I'm going to crush his foes. And that's really what is necessary. If we want to be loving as parents, when somebody does great harm, grave harm, to those we love, we need to stand up for them, and God is doing that. I'm going to pulverize his foes. Goodbye, Christians, especially those who seek to constrain and restrict him. If you were to ask a Christian about David, they don't know his name, have no idea what his name means. They will dispute he was king of Israel because, you know, they're told that there is no proof that there was even a king David. It's all myth. And the only story they know is that he slew Goliath with a stone. And they think even that is a fable because the text has Goliath that, you know, some like 9 feet when the actual Hebrew text shows them at about, 6 foot 6, which was tall for men of that day.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, tall now. that Goliath was a Philistine, and therefore that Dod slew the people who now call themselves Palestinian.
Mm-hmm.
And that Dod's principal and initial attack on him was he was a filthy mouth, uncircumcised Philistine. So God is going to treat fire with fire. It's not something that we can do or should even contemplate doing, but since God is the author of life and these are his people and his place, and they have attacked him and his people and his sons, he's going to fight fire with fire. He's going to plague those who have robbed his son of his status. I mean, if you were to ask Christians, who's the King of Kings? They're going to say, Jesus. No, according to God, it's Dod. If you were to ask Christians, who's the Messiah? They're going to say, Jesus. No, according to God, it's Dod. So Christians need to wear this. They need to own up to it. They've done it. And God's going to hold them accountable.
Yep.
Empirically, having dissected, compared, and analyzed most of what Shaul said and what he wrote, I realized that the principal author of the Christian New Testament was not only replacing Dode with Yosha, but was decreasing Dode's status to elevate his own. And even that's unfair. He didn't replace Dode with Yosha. He replaced Dode with Jesus Christ, who bears no resemblance to Yosha. However, until I invested more time to scrutinize Paul's spoken and written assessment, particularly on this one topic, first in the book of Acts and second in Romans, I had no idea just how irrational and pathetic his attempts had been. For the first time, I understood that the basis of replacement theology is replacing Dode with Jesus Christ. Paul's irrational and counterproductive assessments of Dode were contrived because the father of lies realized that the Masiach's life and lyrics not only undermined his New Testament, they obliterated his credibility. And soon you'll know what we have come to learn. And that's the point we haven't emphasized yet. I've emphasized it other places in these previous shows. But I've said many, many times, Dode is the antidote for Christianity. What is Christianity based on? That the Torah cannot save. And since the Torah condemns and cannot save, that Christianity came up with a new plan called the gospel of grace and salvation through faith. But if Dode was saved, if Dode is right, then Paul was wrong.
Correct.
It's really that simple. Dode violated, because Paul said if you violate one of the Torah's laws, you violated them all and you're guilty of them all. Well, Dode was guilty of a lot of them.
A lot.
And yet God says he's perfect. He's right. He's my son. He's my guy. He's coming back with me. He's the king of kings. He's going to be as brilliant as the sun in my presence. Therefore, Paul was wrong when he said that the Torah could not save. They don't. And he was guilty of a lot of things. So he is the antidote for the primary underlying thesis of Pauline Christianity. As well as the real Messiah. By contrast, Yahweh and Dode share what follows in common. Matter of fact, a lot of times you're just reading this. God is emphasizing over and over again what he and Dode share in common. So this is really a treatise on how similar Dode became to God.
Yahweh.
Now, God, of course, is perfect, and I understand that. But Dode's Mizmor are perfect. Therefore, my steadfast commitment to the truth, my trustworthiness and unrelenting honesty, the realization that I'm reliable and dependable, this word emuna is also a death knell for Paul's argument. If God is committed to the truth, if he is trustworthy and unrelenting in his honesty, then he is reliable and dependable. And that means he's unchanging and without contradiction, resolute and unwavering. If he is those things, then he is not annulling everything he said and replacing it with an entirely different plan. Amuna is the concept that completely and totally destroys Christianity. And so does Chesed, because he says, my love, my devotion, and my enduring favoritism, my unfailing affection and genuine mercy are with him. Well, the Christian mythos is that the God of the Old Testament is mean and wrathful. In fact, in Romans, Paul even says that the Torah is a thing of wrath. And that the gospel of grace replaced it. Well, sorry. But with Doge, Yahweh was steadfastly merciful. Well, why was he merciful to him? Because this fellow chose to learn the truth about Yahweh, to share the truth about Yahweh, to care about what Yahweh cared about. He was right about God, and that was enough for God. That's really all that God is looking for, is someone who cares enough to learn about who he really is, what he actually wants, and engages with him, works with him, loves him, appreciates him.
Can I interject one? If you look at the Torah, it's the only place you find the mitzvah. The mitzvah is the five terms and conditions to become part of his family. Everything about him is good. I mean, everything about him is great and good. And you can only find it in the Torah. How can you say anything negative about the Torah being against you? I mean, you just...
I even stopped and I wrote something today. And I said, you know, that there are countless reasons to reject Paul. You know, the fact that almost all of his arguments are based on rational fallacies is a reason to reject him. The fact that his testimony is counter to everything God said is a reason to reject him. The fact that he constantly misquotes God and misappropriates what he said is a reason to reject him. But the gist of his argument, both in Galatians and in Romans, is based upon Abraham, and he convolutes Abraham's relationship with Yahweh to suggest that Abraham believed and that it was credited as righteousness to him that he believed before he had the Torah and before he was circumcised. And Abraham could not have worked for his salvation under the supposed law because then he would have reason to boast. And so the whole thing is based upon this recasting of Abraham and faith. And so I just said, let's stop here for a moment. If it were not for the Torah, Abraham is completely unknowable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Abraham is only known to us because of the Torah. If the Torah's presentation of Abraham is correct, then Paul's is wholly incorrect. If the Torah's presentation of Abraham is invalid, and the Torah is invalid, then it serves no purpose whatsoever to cite it to prove one's case. That is the core problem of Pauline Christianity. You can't cite the Torah and what it has to say about the life of Abraham and then say that based upon that Torah, I'm annulling the Torah. If the Torah is true, then you can't...
Then you can't tell a lie about it.
Annul the Torah. And if the Torah is false, it's a fool's folly to build a case based on it.
That's so simple. Why is it so difficult for people to get? I know everybody ain't gonna like this regardless, but
religious people.
It just amazes me.
Yeah. It says, wow. In my name, his light will radiate and enlighten. Waba Shem Ani. Quran, who his glowing appearance and ability to enlighten will be brilliant, even his horns, symbolic of his status and strength when worn as a crown, and his role as the protective ram and the sheep will be prominent, as will be his trumpet for singing, which emits light. No, David is like Yahweh in this way. Both share an unwavering commitment to the truth. That's one of the things about Doug. Philip made a lot of mistakes in his personal life and paid dearly for them. But he never slipped up when it came to ferreting out and standing with that which is true.
Mm-hmm.
And so just by grasping hold of and recognizing and conveying that which was true, none of the rest really mattered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough for us. And by the way, you know, if you read what Doud wrote, now, I don't think Doud had near the opportunity that we have to piece it all together. He had some advantages. I mean, yeah, he was inspired to write the Mizmor, and, you know, that's a way, that's a big advantage over what we have. But apart from that, you know, Doud would have had no appreciation of the history and the science that help us pull all of this together. And at the time, there were really no prophets. No prophets. Because while Moshe, there were a lot of prophetic statements in Moshe's work, and Moshe is primarily known as the one who liberated the children of Israel from Mithraim along with Yahweh, and who scribed the Torah and then explained the Torah and the body. And Shamuel, while he made many prophetic statements, he was the last of the judges.
Mm-hmm.
So really the first of the I can't even say pure prophets, because Doud was so much more than a prophet. But,
yeah.
You know, he didn't have the benefit of Yashiyah. Yashiyah would come 300 years later. Yirmiyah, mm-hmm. Well, much later. Malachi, Zechariah, all of these guys. Oh, yeah, they're all later. And so we have that advantage that he didn't have, and yet Doud was able to figure it out. And I think the single greatest contribution that Doud made to the world is the 109th Mizmor. It tells us systematically, letter by letter, going through the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, specifically how to observe the Torah. It's the basis of don't change the stroke
mm-hmm.
on a single letter. So both share this unwavering commitment to the truth. They're both loving. Oh, man, Doud was passionate. Doud had love down, man. And what's so interesting is that Doud was driven by intellect, and yet he may have been the most loving person we will ever know. So you don't have to forego intellect and reason to be loving. And that's, you know, most people would choose love without thinking today. And the kind of love
yeah.
that Doud had was thoughtful.
And really
a lot of people think they're being loving.
More powerful.
What'd you say, JB?
Yeah.
I said love, when it's driven by reason, is more powerful and more lasting than love that is driven by emotion.
Correct. Because there are so many ways to affect emotion. But when you can reason your way to understanding and choose to love what you've come to understand, it really is impossible to break that.
Yep.
You know, I'm not a mushy sort of a guy, but I can tell you that what I have come to know and understand about Yahweh has caused me to fall in love with
him. Sure.
I didn't come there through love. Love was the result. Yep, their relationship, when seen together, it encapsulates the Torah and emulates the covenant. By looking at one, we see the other. Their relationship has made it possible for us to understand and thus experience Yahweh's enduring love and mercy. We cannot and should not follow Yosha. The world does not need another Passover lamb, and that's not a good experience, because the Passover lamb always dies. But we can. follow Dode.
And should.
When Yahweh said this about himself, he destroyed the basis of the Christian religion. Since God is unwavering in his commitment to the truth, he could not have inspired the contradictory message found in the Christian New Testament, especially since it annuls much of what he claimed would be consistently reliable. You know, if you ask a Christian what they're lugging around in their Bible, they'll find Psalm 89 right there. They can't deny it. Since the God of the Torah is genuinely loving and merciful, the gospel of grace is without merit. If it conveys the same message as found in the Torah, which it doesn't, it becomes superfluous. If its message differs, and it does, for it to be true, the statement God just made has to be false. If God stated that his enduring commitment to the truth and mercy were both with Dode, one leads to the other, completely negating salvation through faith. Truth leads to salvation, not faith. Since God associated all of this with Dode, he was saved based on the Torah and not the gospel of grace, on the truth, not faith, relying exclusively on Yahweh 1,000 years before the new God named Jesus Christ was killed. Since all of this occurred in Yahweh's name, there is no room for God by any other name. And since Dode is shown radiating Yah's light rather than being bodily resurrected, he has been transformed, indeed upgraded, from lowly matter to empowered energy. That's another one of the big problems of Christianity. It is counterproductive to be a material being. Bodily resurrection negates the possibility of eternal life. A physical body cannot exist in the fabric of time.
Yeah.
They all degrade. So the whole notion of bodily resurrection is wholly and completely counterproductive.
I was talking to Kirk the other day on the phone and telling him about the goat that they sent to the desert with all the sins of the people on it.
Mm-hmm.
And if that animal returns to the camp, those sins have returned, unpaid for. So the concept of a bodily resurrection of a body which has been cursed, all of the sins of the family on it, it completely, it's asinine. It doesn't even make sense.
Yep. Not much in the Christian New Testament that does. All things occur in Yahweh.
Right.
All good things, from love to enlightenment, from mercy to being converted into light. Also interesting, when Yahweh told Abraham that he would provide the lamb, and he looked up to see the lamb's Karen, radiant light, on the summit of Moriah, based upon this statement, Yahweh could have been symbolically portraying what he would accomplish with Dode 1,000 years later on Moriah. After all, Dode is not only the exemplar of the covenant, beneficiary of the covenant, he's the lone witness to the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim at the same place.
That's big. That is big.
He's the guy that saw them and explained it.
Yeah.
Only one. The only eyewitness to the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim is Dode. And in this very same place, he became the beneficiary and exemplar of the very covenant that Yahweh was establishing with Abraham and Yitzhak. One after the next, every word of this declaration contains a treasure trove of relative insights. And the same is true with the next three statements. They are awesome individually and exceptional collectively. God's status, or Dode's status with God, is both special and secure. He shall call out to me and welcome me, announcing, "You are my father. I also will appoint him my firstborn, the highest of all of the kings and rulers of the earth. For all eternity, I will keep watch over him, paying very close attention to him. My unwavering love, unrelenting devotion, enduring affection, and genuine mercy, as part of my family-oriented covenant agreement, are truthfully presented and will reliably endure with him." Well, now you know the rest of the story. If you ever wanted to know why God is making such a big deal of Dode, this is the reason why. He will call out to me and welcome me, announcing, "You are my father." Is that not the essence of the covenant?
That's it.
Isn't that exactly what we all gain? Isn't that what we seek and what we gain and what we're given?
Abba, my father, yeah.
You are my father. I can say it. You can say it. Those, the essence of the covenant. The covenant isn't a religious relationship. It isn't a submissive relationship. It isn't a legal relationship. It's father, son, father, daughter. You are my father. That's what Dode announces. I also will appoint him my firstborn, Bakor. Bakor Anik, my firstborn. And of that, that's powerful. My firstborn son, serving as the basis of Bakurim, the third of seven Moed Mikre. The highest of all of the kings and rulers of the earth. You know, I struggle with this, because that's one of the things I still thought was something ascribed to Yosha, that he was the expression of Bokor. That was just my summation from what transpired. But here's God himself saying, no, my firstborn, my Bokor, the highest of them all, is Dode. And for a couple of weeks, until he takes a dirt nap, until Jesus comes, or as Paul would write, you know, Dode, you know, did what God wanted him to do during his generation, but, you know, he's taking a dirt nap now, so he doesn't matter anymore. So this is for all eternity. I will keep watch over him. Now, if God is keeping watch over Dode for all eternity, it tells you a lot of stuff, doesn't it? One is that when we become part of Yahweh's covenant family, God watches out for us for all time. He cares about us. He pays attention to what we're doing for all time. He never shirks the responsibility of being our father. I kind of like the idea of God looking out for you and me when we're out enjoying the universe that he's conceived for.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So for all eternity, God's going to watch over him, paying very close attention to him. So I guess, you know, he's not dead and buried, as Paul would write. My unwavering love, unrelenting devotion, enduring affection, and genuine mercy, as part of my covenant family, are truthfully presented and reliably endure with him. Therein is the reason that we're studying what God said about Dode and what we can learn from him. Because with him are all of the things that we seek from Yah. Genuine mercy and unwavering love is part of his covenant family. And he says they are reliably presented and endure. Come on. True. Trustworthy. Verifiable. Confirmed. Credible. Upheld. Everlasting. especially real through him and for him. Now, this all begins with Kara. Yahweh has invited us to meet with him. God has called us out of this world so that we can be welcomed into his. By reading and reciting the word of God, we find our Father summoning us to his side. When we call out to him, inviting him into our lives, he answers our proclamation with one of his own. The promise he has made to us in his Torah. By answering Yahweh's Mikra invitations to be called out and meet with God, we're born into the covenant family, perfected and immortal. As his B'Kudim, firstborn children, Yahweh becomes our father. Dod has shown us the way. As you said, Kirk, let's just follow it.
Yeah. Well, that would, Paul would call that hard, that hard work you had to do to earn your way. Go to a party
yes.
and have wine well, and drink cool. and eat. And, my goodness, this tough stuff is in Torah, man.
Of course, child of the covenant, because I think Noah was part of the covenant. I think that Abraham is part of the covenant. Adam is part of the covenant. We know that Abraham mm-hmm. was part of the covenant, and Abraham existed 1,000 years before Dov. Yishak was obviously part of the covenant. Yaakov was part of the covenant. You know, Yahweh established a covenant relationship with Yaakov's sons. So he is not the first child born into the covenant. And Yahweh is saying, he is my Bakur, firstborn. But what he's saying by that is that the person designated the firstborn gets the lion's share of the inheritance.
Yeah.
That's happening with Dor. He is the one that receives the foremost blessing. What's happening with Dod? So Dod is just being presented as the most important of all of the covenant's children by Bakor, the one that gets the lion's share of the inheritance. Good for me. You know, if let's just say that that Dod's inheritance is a billion times greater than yours and mine.
An infinity?
What does it matter?
Well, so it's 1% of infinity. Ah,
okay, so he gets 99% of infinity, and we get to share 1% of infinity. Okay.
I can deal with it.
I'm good with
you know, Joe's the type of person, though, he'll probably let you play on his golf course if you ask him.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't think you hoard it all. You say, come on.
Well, I think that my guess is that his will be a significant improvement on Pebble Beach, where every hole is on the wall, not just, you know, like 12 of them. Yes, indeed. You know, I think that in Heaven's Golf Course, too, I don't want it to be that, you know, every swing just goes straight down the middle and every putt finds the bottom of the cup. Because I want to play the game.
Of course.
Yes. Yep. You know, I don't want every sip of wine to be perfect, every taste of lamb to be ideal. You know, I don't want to stop with the upgrade over the platypus. More to it than. But Kota Firstborn is the only meaningful title, apart from Pesach AL, that I thought would remain Yosha's alone. By the way, someone wrote me and said AL, Pesach AL. Do you ever think of what comprised that term? It's a ram's head. So he is the lamb. It's Yahweh's hand and the shepherd's staff.
Yeah.
The shepherd's staff, Yahweh's hand, and the ram all combined into that powerful, powerful term. The shepherd and the ram on either side of Yahweh's hand. That's the Pesach Gael. That's a pretty good title.
It is. It's a pretty looking word, too.
Yeah, that's a good looking word. I had seen Bakutam in the year 4000 Yah, the 4th and 5th of April in 33 CE, that I thought was, at least at the time, I thought it was Yosha's Nefesh soul that was being reunited with Yahweh's Ruach spirit as the fulfillment of the Mikre making Yosha Yahweh's firstborn. But as is becoming a frequent event, I was wrong. At least in one way, and perhaps right in a couple of others. Yahweh was honoring his promise to enable the benefits of Bakutam on this day. However, because it was, as we have subsequently surmised, Yahweh's soul, the resulting union was not his son, his firstborn. It was that was being manifested on this day. So this is really an affirmation that it is Yahweh's soul. And, of course, Yosha correctly calls himself the son of man. Yahweh calls Dod the son of God. So this is also important in recognizing Bakur. And plus the fact, if the most you can say about Yosha beyond being the Pesach Eyal, which is a lot, is that he was a diminished manifestation of Yahweh when the set-apart spirit came upon him. But if he is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, then there really is no merit to him being added to the covenant family as a son, much less the firstborn son, because he adds nothing to Yahweh. He's actually part of Yahweh, set apart from Yahweh, so he adds nothing to him. It's the relationship with Dod that adds so much to Yahweh, because it's the entire purpose of creation, because Yahweh grows through the enjoyment of spending eternity with his children.
Correct.
So the distinction of being the first and foremost among the covenant's children is Dod's. He is Yahweh's Bakur. What's more, Yahweh, Nathan Hugh, gave him this title. Bakur, firstborn, was bestowed and appointed upon him as a gift. As wondrous as are the implications of this declaration, Yahweh was not done lauding titles on his favorite son. You know, according to God, Dod is the King of Kings. Elon, the highest and most exalted in status, rank, and position. Lamelech, of all of the kings and rulers on earth. Now, I'm not endorsing the book of Revelation. I think that it's just like the book of Yahochanan and little bits of Matanyah. If there's places that affirm the prophets and the Torah, and they present an insight on them that is consistent and helps us understand by making connections, then that's fine. So I'm going to read a section of Revelation. It's Revelation 19, 1 through 16, that Christians say is their Jesus. But it can't be their Jesus. But it sure sounds like that Yahochanan, if he indeed wrote it, saw Dod on his return. It says, "Now I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on him was called Faithful," Emuna, "and True," Tzedak, "and in righteousness he judges and makes war." Who makes great decision and makes war? Dod. "His eyes were like the flame of fire." Isn't God soon going to say that Dod appeared like the sun in his presence? "And on his head were many crowns." He's just been called the greatest of all the kings of earth. "And he had a name written that no one knew except himself." Well, when he comes back, unless you're reading this, you're not going to know his name is Dod. Nobody else is calling him Dod. No one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood. What did Yahweh say? You know, Dodo, I love you, but you're not going to build my house because
too much blood.
Of what?
And of war.
Yes, on your hands.
And of war, exactly.
And his hand and his name is called the Word of God. Well, of all the people who could be considered this warrior king, who wrote the Word of God?
Dodo wrote the most of all.
Yep.
No,
and the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on the white horse. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, and with it that he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. Only been promised to Dodo. He himself treads the winepress, which, by the way, he bought, with the fierceness of the wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his robe and on his thigh the name written, King of Kings.
It narrows down the field, don't it?
Yeah, it's dope. Well, that's the way it's coming back.
Yeah.
Once again, what Christians have presumptuously claimed for their Christ was actually written on behalf of Yahweh's Messiah, the true King of Kings. As Yahweh's Gibor, Dodo will be riding the white horse. He is the one Yahweh has called Emunah and Tzedak. He is God's righteous warrior. And don't be taken back by the flames of fire, because as we shall soon discover in this Mizmor, Dodo shall appear as the sun before Yahweh. It is Dodo's crown which God has spoken. It is Dodo's name which few knew. And though preferring to relegate David to a time long past, with many denying his very existence, it was even the blood of Dodo shed protecting his people that will appear on his robe, the very blood which caused God to have the house whose foundation he had acquired, whose materials he had accumulated, and whose plans he had studied, erected by his son, just as Yahweh would erect the enduring nature of the covenant through his son, Dodo. More than anyone else, Dodo wrote the word of God. And Yahweh is returning with Dodo to strike the Gentile nations, ending their rule with a rod of iron. Pay reference to smiting what Rome has come to represent. It is even Yahweh's garden that Dodo was asked to tend. And Yahweh's focus on Dodo is temporary. The Pauline notion that Dodo and the Torah he loved were only relevant until the arrival of Jesus Christ is torn asunder with Olam Shamar, Lahu. For all eternity, I will keep watch over him, paying very close attention to him, focusing upon him, while observing all there is to know about him forevermore. And should we wonder why Yah would remain attuned to Dodo's every move, even through eternity, answer simple. Yahweh loves him as a father loves a son. God said, Chesed Ani, Wa Bereth Ani, Aman Lahu, my unwavering love, unrelenting devotion, and enduring most mercy are truthfully presented and will reliably endure with him as part of my covenant family, as part of my pledge to build my family and raise, or build my home and raise my family. Even when they act up as parents, we never tire of our children. And when they devote themselves to the protection and betterment of the family, when they go about their father's business, every moment is a cause for celebration. This is not only why we have children, it's why we exist. When we explore everything this one word represents, when we value Bereth more than any other, when we understand why it exists and apply its every nuance to our lives, we are home. We are family. We will be as Dodo, the firstborn son, of God, his primary focus, the recipient of his parental love. For these reasons, Dode is the exemplar of the covenant, embodying everything upon which it stands. You know, it's a we've said that we're comfortable with Dode getting the lion's share, speaking of the Lion of Yehuda, of what God has offered. When God says that he is going to continually focus on Dode, closely examining and carefully considering everything Dode does for all eternity, it doesn't take anything away from us. God is absolutely capable of focusing on Dode and still paying very close attention to everything we're doing. We can have a personal, moment-to-moment, enduring, personal and close relationship with God. At the same time, God is enjoying Dode's presence.
If
well,
we could,
similarities.
Would it stop? Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, with Dode's similarities to Yahweh, I imagine he'll be a very a good king. Pleasant to be around.
Oh,
I'm sure Dode's going to be pleasant to be around, but
for us, anyway.
The fact of the matter is that God's devotion to and enduring commitment to Dode not only don't take anything away from us, it's
right.
a message to us that we're going to receive very similar treatment. God's consistent. If he did this for Dode for these reasons, he's going to do the same thing for us. We won't get as prominent a place, but that's a very good thing.
Yes.
It means you get to enjoy the benefits without the responsibility.
Yeah.
I'm down.
Yeah. So it's an amazing ride. And we're a long way from finished, and we haven't yet even considered the basis of Christianity. I mean, that's we haven't got to the end of the psalm. In fact, this psalm goes, I think we're about halfway through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is a lot to learn, and I know that some people are saying, God, we get rid of off with this Dode wagon for a while, and I'll just focus on the greatness of Yahweh. Well, we are focusing on the greatness of Yahweh.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is his shining person, his shining sun.
Well, this is his example.
He's pretty focused
this is what
on him. He just did so for eternity. Maybe we should focus on him a little bit ourselves. Come on.
And maybe all of the Yisraelites and the Udem that are in this world who are estranged from God ought to listen to Dode, ought to follow him, ought to be more attuned to him and find their way back home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They should be jumping up and down over this news.
This
is great.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely
great.
Great.
Listen, it's great news for all of us, but spectacular news for Yisrael and Yehuda. It means that the one
they
that they can
the monkey
embrace,
their back. Yeah,
that's right, is one of their own. That's what it means. It's one of their own.
Yeah. Yes.
It's the most of their own.
Yes.
It means they don't have to accept the caricature of Jesus Christ that has done so much harm, has been abused to do so much harm to them.
Yep.
And now they know that Jesus could not have been the Messiah. Doesn't fit the prophecies.
Right.
But Dode does. All right, well, we have reached the end of our time. We're 15 minutes even past our broadcast time, so I want to thank you, Dee, for participating. I know that JB has just dropped off. Didn't know he was even going to be able to be with us today. Kirk, I wish you all the best with you and
your
beloved wife, and hope that she benefits from all of the care that she's receiving and begins to feel so much better. And thank you all for listening.
Thanks for having me.
Before you go, do I need to do anything on this Blog Talk Radio screen?
Nope, not a thing. It will. You hang up, it will be over, and so we will we will be done. Thank you for calling in.
My pleasure. I'm delighted it worked.
Next Friday, I'm going to be off on a adventure. We're leaving Harbor Island and moving out. I think on Friday, I'm going to be in Cape Eleuthera. Maybe in Hawk's Nest, but hopefully there'll be a cell tower and internet connectivity, and we'll get this done. And ultimately, a little over 2 weeks from now, I hope to be positioned in the British Virgin Islands and make that a home base. And the level of infrastructure there should be sufficient that we're able to do a much better job on the show and actually start the simulcasts on the networks. So that's my hope.
Great.
So I wish you all the best, Kirk. Best to Terry.
Thank you.
And may all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night.
Shalom.
Happy Shabbat. Thanks, Kirk. Shalom.
Good night.
Night.